Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting and by GoDaddy.com. Register your domain name with GoDaddy and get free hosting with a website builder, a free blog, complete email, and much more. As a Film Spotting listener, enter code FILM3, that's FILM3, and get your .com domain name for just $6.95 a year. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Hallgren. Coming up on today's show, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Calexico, and the first film in our six-week Screwball Comedies Marathon, The Thin Man.
Plus, we'll reveal our top five mindbenders, but first, sex, drugs, and paranoia. Richard Linklater adapts Philip K. Dick's A Scanner Darkly.
It may just be my imagination. Whatever it is that's watching, it's not human.
Gentlemen, you are about to witness for approximately 61 cents the perfect homemade silencer.
That sure is some silencer.
Take all the slackers, stoners, and pseudo-intellectuals that have populated Richard Linklater's films over the past 15 years, and imagine them 7 years in the future. Paranoid, living in squalor, victims of a drug epidemic that is destroying them one at a time. Welcome to the cheerless world of Linklater's A Scanner Darkly. Adapted from the book by the master of paranoid science fiction, Philip K. Dick, Linklater uses the interpolative rotoscoping animation technique he first used in 2001's Waking Life to give Dick's story, a bitter elegy for a generation of friends lost to drugs, the look of a graphic novel come to life. Adam, A Scanner Darkly made both of our top five most anticipated movies of the year. We both like Linklater, particularly the episodic, lightly plotted, talky stuff like Slacker, Dazed and Confused, Before Sunrise and Before Sunset, and Waking Life. Dick's sci-fi paranoia has been adapted with big-budget extravagance by the likes of Ridley Scott, Paul Verhoeven, and Steven Spielberg, and doesn't seem the most obvious fit for someone like Linklater, which is one of the things which made it look so compelling. Does it work?
I guess in comparison to those other filmmakers, maybe Linklater doesn't seem like a guy who would be best suited for this. And,
sure.
And I assume you mean, too, just because of the fact that it's sci-fi.
Yeah,
right. Because otherwise, this has Linklater written all over it.
Sure, but the
it?
Fact that, yeah, Linklater may be more adept at handling life as it is as opposed to how it might be.
Sure, but otherwise you have here, you know, a movie that consists almost entirely of people walking around and sitting around and talking,
right.
Usually having lengthy philosophical and mostly rambling.
The very definition of a Linklater film.
Exactly, yeah. Rambling conversations. That is Linklater. And does it work? I think maybe the best way to answer that question is to explain the circumstances under which I saw the film. Tuesday night,
I
was
in... As if
you
were a character in the film.
Exactly. Tuesday night, I was in Montreal for work, and I just come off a trip for fun. I'll discuss it a little bit later in the show. I was in San Francisco for the weekend, and I got home. I had about 9 hours to spend at home, got 3 hours of sleep before I had to get on a plane, go to Montreal, and I had to see this movie. It was the only chance I was going to get before we recorded. So I go see it, 3 hours of sleep, completely exhausted.
After dropping how many tabs of crystal meth or whatever?
Exactly, five.
Five, I think, right.
And, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night. I'm completely exhausted, and I'm a little nervous that even though I'm really anticipating this film, is it going to be able to hold my attention? And the fact is, I sat there the entire 2 hours or whatever with a smile on my face. Mm-hmm. And I think the smile comes from not only the fact that I was just generally enjoying the film, but the film did surprise me with its humor. And maybe it shouldn't have, because we've seen it in his other films. There's humor in Before Sunrise, certainly in Dazed and Confused, but in Slacker too, in Waking Life, there are some real interesting humorous moments. And you've got here Robert Downey Jr. just really giving a tremendous performance, a tremendous comedic performance, both from a talking standpoint and his timing, but also his mannerisms and his physical humor is really hilarious here. So the movie surprised me with how funny it was, and I just sat there the whole time enjoying listening to these people talk, much like I did with other Linklater films like Waking Life. But it is interesting that, you know, we got an email from John Colletti in Wheaton, and we read some of his comments about the proposition a few weeks ago on the show. He had some interesting remarks, and he said here that this, for him, was a surprise, just like the breakup was for a lot of people, where people went in expecting a romantic comedy, and it was a romantic drama, and it was serious. And here, he and his friend went in, and they liked the movie ultimately, but they went in really thinking it was going to be this
big
hardcore
Philip K. Dick fans.
Yeah, hardcore paranoid vision of the future,
right.
And it was really going to be just this mind bender, like
right.
our top five, really, truly a mind bender. And instead, it ends up being kind of a funny movie in a way, and it
yeah.
just didn't have that kick. And they're right. You get to the end of this film, and you realize that you could have gone a completely different direction with the movie. But what I think is so fascinating about it, and why Linklater maybe doesn't go in the direction that the ending of the movie, which I'm not going to give away,
right.
but the ending suggests this movie could have gone in a different direction, been much
conspiracy
more plot-heavy,
laden
much
and,
more,
yeah.
yes, you know, like a movie from the 70s, that, sure. you know, a conspiracy movie that we've seen 100 times. It could have gone in that direction. I think it doesn't, because he knows that this vision of the future really isn't that prophetic anymore. It's here.
Yeah.
This is the present day. We go from Philip K. Dick writing a story that he wrote in the early 70s. He
right.
started it, published in the mid-70s,
mm-hmm.
and it's projected ahead to like 1992. So this is supposed to be kind of this far-out future.
Right.
Here, Linklater gives us the 7 years from now, which is kind of this code for saying this is the future, but not really.
Yeah.
The only thing that's really futuristic about it are the scramble suits, these suits that these wear to keep them anonymous, that
right.
Keanu Reeves walks around, and that is futuristic, obviously. We don't have something like that today. But otherwise, these ideas of, I mean, come on, they're fighting a war. We hear they're fighting a war for
right.
without a cause,
yeah.
you know.
Where the little blue flowers are planted.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you've got, you know, people on this, you know, there's this drug epidemic in the country
yeah.
and all stuff. It's like, it's here. This
yeah.
idea that, you know, we're being wiretapped, that
yeah,
people are watching us. I mean,
sure.
I'm not suggesting that we're living in the state that we see here exactly in this movie. But the fact is, those ideas and this kind of paranoid vision of the future isn't a vision of the future anymore. It's
right.
the present day. And so instead, what you get is you get Linklater kind of bringing it back down to that level, taking out the sci-fi aspect in some
mm-hmm.
way and making it a movie about characters existing just like we would expect them to today.
Yeah, and I guess that's part of my problem. And I really, it's interesting. I really have a hard time giving a kind of final judgment on this film because I ultimately didn't enjoy it. I really didn't. I really ultimately didn't care enough about what the characters were after or really what particularly Keanu Reeves' character, Bob Arctor, is after or what he's trying to investigate or what Linklater's trying to investigate. And you said it, I thought it too. It's like, this isn't a vision of the future. This is a vision of our present, heightened.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a drug epidemic where 20% of the population is addicted to this substance D, which really, the only thing it seems to do is kill you very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
We don't actually see any of the euphoria of drug addiction, really,
true.
Like we do in other films. And so my thing is, if it is ultimately a look at our present as opposed to our future, it didn't, for me, offer any special insight into the government as this grand, you know, survey, you know, somebody that's surveying our daily lives
mm-hmm.
and every moment of our lives. I didn't feel the paranoia that the characters, I would expect the characters to feel knowing they're living in that kind of society.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't necessarily understand and didn't understand the rules of the society that Linklater is creating in some sense. I mean, we do have one scene where we see this room full of people that are clearly monitoring the everyday lives of people, and that's it. And then
right.
otherwise, I guess I never got a sense of irony at all that the fact that the bulk of the surveillance is on this small group of small-time drug dealers and drug users. And yes, they're a lot of fun to be around,
mm-hmm.
Robert Downey Jr. in particular, but I didn't understand why. And I know there's a lot of, there's a sort of a personal journey that Keanu Reeves' character, the central character, goes on. And it's like, there's a kind of sorrow in terms of the life he's given up, and he is this undercover cop. But it didn't necessarily, I never understood what he was after or what he was trying to investigate other than his own addiction.
Okay. I mean, that is ultimately what the whole film is about, though. It's about this kind of inner schism of being torn between being two people and living in this world where you're constantly under surveillance, whether they even know it or not. But it becomes this kind of world where you're questioning your own identity to the point where you're not even sure who you are anymore. And I think that's something that we can all relate to on some level, despite not living in this quote-unquote futuristic vision. So I'm not really sure where you're going, because how can you appreciate a movie like Slacker, which you do?
Yeah, I think it's
and not appreciate
not
a movie like this.
I think because Slacker is in some sense about these snippets of everyday lives of people thinking that they have some sort of insight, trying to create something out of nothing. In some sense,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they really are doing nothing and reflecting on nothing, or what their lives amount to. With this, I kept feeling like I was going to get caught up in the paranoia or the sense of, the sense of the daily lives you're living, or what are they after? What are they trying to capture with this drug? But everyone is just, everyone seems small time to me. And so I kept expecting, with the government's role in the battle of this drug epidemic in some sense, I kept waiting for the epiphany in some way, or to feel the sense of the world closing in on me as it closes in on the Keanu Reeves' character. And I never really went on that journey with him. And I eventually just got bored of the lives they're living, because the conversations they have, the little asides, they don't amount to anything. And again, you could tell me, yes, Slacker doesn't really amount to anything.
It doesn't.
Other than it offers some slice of a very particular time and place.
I mean, and I think you get that exact same thing here. And I feel like you maybe went in thinking the same thing that a guy like John did, which is that you expected this bigger plot in some way. You almost expected, it sounds like, a V for Vendetta type scenario, right, where we would start to understand, even though that movie doesn't do a good job with it either, but you would start to understand who exactly the government is and what they're trying to do and what their role is in all this. And that's just not, I feel like, what the movie is about. It's a disintegration. It's a story of disintegration of one person's psyche, really, and identity.
Right.
And that, for me, is enough alone to just watch that sort of dissolve, watch that disintegration process happen. That was fascinating enough for me.
Yeah, and for me, I recognized that. I was like, okay, we have a central character who is watching watching himself disintegrate in some sense. I mean, at one point in the film, he's asked to survey his own life. And I think there's something really interesting there, and I kept waiting to be excited by that fact, by the philosophical dilemma that Keanu Reeves' character has. And I never was. And honestly, and this is what I want to say, like what I started to say at the beginning was that I was very reluctant to like condemn this movie, and I'm not condemning it. I'm just saying I feel like I missed something. I just felt like there was an opportunity for me here where other people are going on this ride and really completely compelled by the characters and entertained by the characters and really moved in some sense by the journey he goes through, and I just didn't have it. And so I feel like I remember a couple reviews that were really interesting to me, watching like early Ebert and Siskel and Ebert. I loved the kind of like thumbs down that he would give, but sort of admit that, you know what, maybe you'll be able to enjoy it. I didn't, but maybe I just missed something. And it's that kind of like 2-star review that I'm giving this film, where I even went back. I mean, one of our listeners sent us a link. You can actually watch the first 24 minutes of Scanner Darkly online.
Yeah.
And I went back and watched it again, 'cause I was like, I'm sure that I missed something in like some piece of information that Keanu Reeves' character gives us, something about his journey, something about his, you know, the horror that he's experiencing watching himself die from the head down.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I see it, but I'm still not in it.
Okay.
I'm still not there.
I don't get that, of course, because I had a completely different experience with it. And I have to say, I was hooked from the second scene of this film where we are introduced to Keanu Reeves' character, where we see him inside this suit and we see this battle going on between what he has to say to the world about this drug problem and then the person on the inside we see underneath the mask.
Right.
I was immediately sucked in to that, and I was even more sucked in when we got to the point where then we realize that he's actually surveilling himself. This idea that he is both a cop and the person the cops are after, that blew me away. That was enough. I mean, maybe I'm not enough of a sci-fi guy, and so these things like that, you know, it doesn't seem that far out there, but it was far enough out for me to be sucked in and want to figure that out. And I loved all the performances in this film. Once again, Keanu Reeves proving for me that he can act. I think he's phenomenal here this film. Robert Downey Jr. is great. And I even thought Winona Ryder was good in this film, though, as I said to you actually last night briefly. It's interesting that she's playing a character. All these people are kind of playing double characters. They're all leading double lives in some way. She's much better when she's playing the second character.
Right.
When Winona Ryder's just playing the first surface-level character, she's not nearly as effective, and I haven't figured out why that is, but I think it's somehow appropriate considering how confusing this film is and what it's about. And then you get to, you know, of course, the visual style of it, which I love anytime you have a movie that has a visual style like this, something that is unique, and yet it's not a gimmick.
Right.
I mean, think about it. How else could you bring this story to life on the screen? How could you tell a story about people
in scramble
suits?
Well, you'd be spending $95 million, right?
Yeah, I mean, but I don't even know how you would pull that off. And here, the rotoscoping, that kind of animation where they're going back and coloring it in after the live action, it just is so perfect. And my favorite thing about the film, honestly, was just watching the little moments when a character would walk into a room and the camera might, the focus might shift, and the furniture in the living room, it's all just amorphous. The furniture would just slide and shift and things go in and out of focus. And that was enough for me, again, to just be like, it's so matching what is going on inside the character's head.
Well, I did. I thought the
visual technique was
awesome.
I
thought it was totally effectively used, because really what you do is get like an exaggeration of the physical and psychological condition of the characters without really disturbing the reality that he creates. And I think as a graphic novel come to life, it may be the most successful use, really successful case of that attempt in some mm-hmm. way, you know. And I think it's fascinating to look at, but again, I just wasn't interested in these characters' lives. And I don't think it's necessarily that I expected a big, you know, conspiracy laden film. I just wasn't interested in the characters, or where they were going, or what they were after, or the dilemma they saw themselves in. It just wasn't interesting to me. And I thought, I didn't immediately blame Keanu Reeves, but I went back and I think it might have something to do with the fact that he doesn't have a lot of range as an actor. And I just don't think that examining his life, watching his life disintegrate in front of his eyes, for me, he wasn't able to convey that. And he speaks all his lines in this kind of morose kind of reverence in some way. There's no conflict with how he approaches this material, I think. So.
I disagree.
All right. Well, Keanu Reeves again, causing us to have a big
disagreement.
Fight.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you've seen A Scanner Darkly and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. Tell me why I should like this film. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
After the break, liking Love Story means never having to say you're sorry. The best movies you should have hated are up next in listener feedback. Plus, stick around for your chance to win a free DVD in Massacre Theater. But first, some recent audio feedback.
Hey guys, this is Tim Minichi from Columbus, Ohio. And with regards to episode 112 and the movie score top 5, I think there was one piece of iconic American movie cinema music that you missed. All right, bad 70s keyboard synthesizer horns aside, the Rocky movies define what a movie montage, what a training montage is supposed to be. Adam, Sam, you're the best. You're the best around. Nothing's gonna ever keep you down.
Cruel grounds leak truths never found. Torturous waves whisper from the grave. Slow spun song of distortion. Bitter.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. It's time to announce the winner of this week's PeerFlix DVD giveaway. Of course, the disc, the Criterion Collection edition of Yi Yi, the Edward Yang film, just out on DVD last Tuesday. And the winner is Andy Allen from Milford, Ohio. Congratulations, Andy. Look for your copy of Yi Yi, a film Sam thinks is right up there with Tokyo Story.
Tokyo Story, put it in the Film Spotting University syllabus.
It's on the syllabus. There you go. Look for your copy of Yi Yi in the mail soon, courtesy of PeerFlix, a new way to get DVDs cheap. It's only 99 cents every time you get a DVD in the mail, and over 200,000 DVDs are available on the network. Sign up now at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
Sign up for a PeerFlix account now, and you'll be entered to win its last call for action. That's right, Roadhouse Deluxe Edition, out on DVD this week, along with ATL, Clean with Maggie Cheung, and last year's Best Foreign Film Oscar winner, Sotsi, We'll announce the winner on next Wednesday's show.
Yes, we will. And the Roadhouse Deluxe Edition, of course, we picked that as this week's giveaway.
People are hungry for it.
The So Bad It's
Good
Ultimate
Movie. We all have the original DVD edition.
Well, we should. You know, I don't think I bought it because there were no extra features. And this time, Sam, speaking of that, we get extra features this time. If you're thinking, why would I ever want to own Roadhouse? It's probably worth it just to hear the commentary track by Roadhouse fans Kevin Smith and Scott Mosier. I hear it's very funny. And it's a very funny commentary, especially when you compare it to the other commentary track on the disc by the director Rowdy Harrington, the immortal Rowdy Harrington. I guess from what I've read about it, he doesn't really get the joke.
Yeah,
he's ultra serious the entire time.
It. That's even
which
that could be even
that's
better.
The ultimate
again,
kind of comedy.
So bad commentary, so bad it's good.
It's good.
So, I think he probably gets the honorary Parmistan Award for directing
the Parmy.
The Parmy, I think they call it. Greatest so bad it's good film of all time.
Yeah, there you have it. So I'm excited. I'm going to be very jealous of anyone who wins that. Yeah. Also, you missed in there, Sam, in the roster of new DVDs, Some Like It Hot Collector's Edition.
Okay.
Two-disc edition is coming out. It's got a couple documentaries and a commentary and some other look-back nostalgia things about that film. So Some Like It Hot, a great film, classic comedy, also out on DVD this week. And we did, before we got off the PeerFlix thing, briefly, we wanted to mention a couple of things, including an email we got from Chad Skelton in Vancouver, Canada, who wrote in and said that he'd like to suggest that we mention on one of our shows that PeerFlix is available to Canadians. As a loyal listener, I've heard ads for PeerFlix on your program for months now, but always assumed incorrectly that it was a U.S.-only service like Netflix that I couldn't join. Then I came across another website that mentioned that PeerFlix has a separate service for Canadians, too. I recently signed up, but the inventory north of the border is still fairly weak. I'm hoping if you give the Canadian service a mention, all those cool film-spotting listeners with their great DVD collections will join, and I'll have a better chance of getting the DVDs I want. Well,
fantastic.
Chad, consider it done.
Mentioned, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, so
get
it
all
is,
your Adam McGoyan films in there.
Please
in
do. U.S. and Canadian service. Please feel free to join if you're in Canada and have some DVDs to trade.
Yeah.
Also, Sam.
Yeah, we want to mention, too, just the fact that PeerFlix are making changes all the time, listening to PeerFlix users. In the past, I think there were some complaints that people were being charged for sending out DVDs and maybe not getting them back as quickly as they were sending them out.
They had to put stamps on them.
No longer. Now their postage is actually already applied to the PeerFlix mailer when you print it out. So another improvement with PeerFlix, another reason to go check it out.
Definitely. And recently, Sam, you wanted to mention a couple of the recent movies you traded for.
An overlooked film of mine that I know, certainly Ed Norton's performance in American History X, a film I have not yet seen that I recently got from PeerFlix, and also Hal Hartley's Amateur, one of my favorite Hal Hartley films, a great little overlooked film as well.
Okay, so those of you who think sometimes maybe there's not enough out there, not enough diversity, you can get some great
you
films.
Certainly
Hal
can.
Hartley
listen to that, yeah.
And Ed Norton's American History X. Okay, donations this week, Sam.
Yes.
Let's hear the nicknames. People who have been so generous as to go to the filmspotting.net site, click on the PayPal link, and we had a lot of people.
A lot
who
of people
this week.
Yeah, thanks so much. And this is the Scanner Darkly inspired nickname. Thanks to Michael Rosie Fingered Don of Psychosis, Michael Third World Hallucination, Jonathan. First you get the money, then you get arrested. Brendan, 12 easy steps to binge drinking. Christopher, no breaks on the night train. Reginald, 13% paranoia. Ramesh, peyote sunshine. Mark, hash on the barrelhead. Eric, crack den father figure. And finally, Hannah, flight of angel dust. Thanks to everybody.
Well done,
that
Sam.
Donated this week.
Yes, and we also want to thank Jonathan Jackal, who wrote in, one of our listeners, wrote in and he said he's loved the show for a long time, finally decided that he should be contributing. And we do appreciate, obviously, every cent that we get in addition to the money we make from donations from PeerFlix. We are using that money to pay for the show and also saving some of it because we are going to eventually be turning out an enhanced podcast. We are going to use it for things like going to film festivals around the country, giving you better coverage. And also, of course, using that money to advertise and promote the show and grow the show. So we are going to put the money to good use. And he wrote and he said that he noticed that our site doesn't suggest a donation size or provide an option for donations. Another podcaster I support, Leo Laporte, has made subscriptions available through PayPal at $2 a month. It's a nearly painless way of paying $24 a year, plus I don't have to do another thing until I decide that I don't want to subscribe anymore, in which case I can cancel the subscription through PayPal. This could provide you guys a steady revenue stream and a fairly reliable count of your core listenership. You might consider it.
In a perfect world, it's true.
That was a really interesting idea, and we did consider it, and actually, as of today, you can go to our site.
Yeah.
You can donate if you feel free, a few bucks, or if you want to contribute $2 a month. You can click on that link as well, and we would appreciate it. Of course, you shouldn't feel obligated, but the option is there.
Right. So thanks again to Jonathan. First you get the money, then you get arrested. Jackal.
Poll questions this week, Sam. Actually, I always want to jump to this week, but last week's question first. We asked, tying in with The Scanner Darkly, what is Richard Linklater's best film?
Yeah, best film. Dazed and Confused, Before Sunset, Before Sunrise, School of Rock, Waking Life, or Slacker. And as expected,
no
surprise. No surprises. 40% of you answered Dazed and Confused. Right behind that, though, Before Sunset at 18%, then School of Rock at 16%, Before Sunrise at 13%, and Waking Life at 8%. And then Slacker, I'm telling you people, go and watch Slacker.
Would you amend your vote now, Sam, and give it to Slacker?
I would.
I would,
absolutely. I think it's a complete masterpiece, and I like a lot of the films on this list,
yes.
But this film is just a work of art.
I like all the films on here, actually, and so other than Dazed and Confused, like I said, I'd still stick with Before Sunset, and I was happy to see that that actually came in second. People were out there. People were in agreement with us. School of Rock at 16%. I like School of Rock. I think it's funny, but I was surprised to see it third on the list.
But they shooed nostalgia and went for maybe the better quality films.
Okay. Well, this week's poll question, we're going to have two reviews on next week's show. Two new movies coming out, Clerks 2 and Lady in the Water, the new movie from M. Night Shyamalan. So we're asking you quite simply, which new movie are you more excited about, Clerks 2 or Lady in the Water?
Or neither.
Or I won't see either. So we want to know from you, Sam, right now, what's your answer?
Well, I plan on seeing both, to be honest.
Of course.
I was gonna skip Lady in the Water, but Clerks 2. I mean, Clerks is, this sort of cult phenomenon movie. I know a lot of people absolutely love it. It's a film I like, but I haven't loved a lot of Kevin Smith's other films. I like Chasing Amy a lot, but the other ones I could have taken or left. But among those choices, it's going
to
be Clerks
2. I have to say, too, I'm actually way more excited about Clerks 2 only because, as you know, I've been telling you, I think the previews for Lady in the Water just look atrocious.
I don't think they look that bad, but my God, it sounds like there's like a stampede of bad press about Lady in the Water.
I've seen it 100 times now, and it never is good. And all the variations of the trailer, none of them are good. In fact, some of them are quite bad.
Downright awful.
They are. So I'm nervous about having to sit through that. But a couple other quick notes here before we jump into the mailbag. This week's Reverbose giveaway winner, Reverbose Records, of course, giving away a copy of Keith Jenkins and the Moving Parts, their self-titled CD. The winner this week is Rachel Coker. Rachel, send us an email, and we'll get Keith Jenkins' CD out to you. And also, we've been meaning for weeks now, Sam, to mention our fan website, I guess you have to call it that, crackspotting.com.
That's right.
It used to be cinecrack.com, now crackspotting.com,
right.
Set up by one of our listeners who's very adept with graphics and every week listens to the show and puts a nice, funny little jab at the show. And every week it makes us laugh.
It really does. It's really incredible stuff. So please go check it out, crackspotting.com.
There is a link directly on our site, too, under Friends of Film Spotting on our site. You can find it in the right rail or just go to crackspotting.com every week. It really is fun. We wanted to give a shout out there. Listener feedback, Sam, let's jump into the mailbag. We got an email here from our good friend Magnus.
It's been a while.
In Berlin. We haven't heard from Magnus in Berlin for quite a while, and he's got a top five list of movies he should have hated, tying in with our top five from last week. Number five, B-Season. When Richard Gere comes on the screen, I normally have to leave the room. Also, I have no interest in spelling bees whatsoever, but this film from last year is an overlooked gem, overlooked by us, Sam.
If Magnus says it's an overlooked gem, that means I'm going
to
check it out.
I do trust Magnus's opinion here. Number four, a movie you love, Sam, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah.
Number three, Fight Club. He really dislikes David Fincher, but really liked Fight Club. And number two, a tie, Man on the Moon and Punch Drunk Love. He says, I don't like Jim Carrey and I hate Adam Sandler, but both of these movies are really good. And after Magnolia, I'd already given up on P.T. Anderson. Sorry, Sam. Should be apologizing to me, too.
And I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know how you feel about Man on the Moon, but I
like it.
Do you?
Yeah,
I think Carrie's fine, but I think the movie is.
It's okay.
Not as good as Punch Drunk Love.
No, it's not. No, it's Milos Forman, though,
isn't it? Yes, it is.
Okay. I like Jim Carrey in it. And lastly, the movie I referenced in the tease there going
in to
the break. Number one for Magnus, Love Story. There were a lot of things I knew about this movie that made me never want to see it. That cheesy never having to say your sorry line, the music, the dramatic ending. But when I had really nothing to do at work and it was on, I watched it. And I'll tell you what, this is actually quite enjoyable.
Unbelievable.
Which I would have never believed, but I'm not rushing out to see Oliver's Story. Then again, he says, you know, you never know.
You never know.
So, Magnus from Berlin, thank you.
I'm sold on B-Season, but honestly, a Love Story, I'm not sure. I mean, we've talked in the past about films like, we're going to stand up and be like, I'm never going to watch that.
And right.
I think Love Story just may fall into that category really? For me. I don't know. I'm not. I just think there are other films I need to see.
My mom actually named my sister Allie
wow.
after Allie McGraw.
Yes. For the legacy continues.
Yes, that's right.
I do want to mention briefly, why are you not hearing any feedback on Pirates of the Caribbean? It's not because none of you wrote in to share your opinions. We will get to it, actually, in the next show.
Yes.
Film Spotting 115, I think.
Which I believe
be
it
the
is.
WBEZ
We're going to save
show.
It for that show, our Chicago right. Public Radio edition.
Right. Okay, well, this one is from Stuart Kazanow in Reisterstown,
Stuart,
Maryland.
200 rubles,
that's right. Who writes that, here are some 80s flicks I truly thought I'd hate and ended up liking. He's got Valley Girl, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Desperately Seeking Susan, The Empire Strikes Back, and also Bronco Billy. But he also adds one recent film that surprised him, and it's mm-hmm. Notting Hill. He says, not a Julia Roberts fan for the longest time, and he hated no actor more than Hugh Grant. I had never seen an actor mug as much as he had. He was the weak link in Sense and Sensibility, and I will never forget the torture of having to sit through 30 minutes of 9 months. But Notting Hill was a charming little flick. I actually, gasp, liked Grant as the lead, no mugging in sight, and Julia Roberts was equally good, and the supporting cast was great. And while I still haven't had the desire to go back and see if Four Weddings and a Funeral was worth my time, it did get me into the doors of About a Boy, which I also loved. And
so there you
email.
Go. We've got Magnus admitting he had a thing for
a
Love Story.
Theme going here.
And Stuart here gets a little romantic with Notting Hill. And the reason we wanted to read this, Sam, is because we both agree.
We totally agree.
Notting Hill, I don't know if it's a film that has come up, but it's a movie that I may have put it on or considered it for my date movies list, but I actually do think it's a pretty charming little movie.
And I remember liking it too. And then, I mean, so many people... make fun of it in some way, or throw it into a category of really just bad films, bad romantic comedies, that I've started to think that maybe I was under...
No.
I think it is.
I think it's actually a
pretty good.
Decent film. Okay. This one from Dan in Walnut Creek, California. He's got an interesting top five list, but we wanted to get to his number one, which is Exotica.
Yeah.
For almost 80 episodes, I've been crossing my fingers that you'll talk about this Canadian gem, but now I guess I'll just have to take the bull by the horns and do it myself. My literature major roommate brought this home and insisted I watch it. With a name like Exotica and a picture of a stripper on the cover, my expectations were obviously quite low. I don't know why they weren't high.
I don't either. What is wrong here?
The movie entranced me almost immediately. Adam Egoyan gave me a visually spectacular look at jealousy, trust, remorse, and tragedy. He challenged me to reevaluate characters that I'd branded as either pathetic or malicious in this movie, and as a consequence, it's something I try to adopt in the real world as well. I'll be forever grateful to him and my horn dog roommate for making me realize that my life is too short to watch mediocre movies. So, Dan, we both agree.
Yeah.
I can't believe Exotica hasn't come up.
Either.
I like Adam Egoyan a lot. We love The Sweet Hereafter, but I also very much like Exotica, and I'm sure it will come up at some point.
And Dan doesn't tell us what the roommate thought of it. Was he as disappointed as
no,
Dan Lays?
No, that's true. And maybe Exotica will come up when we do our top five stripper movies.
It's inevitable.
A couple
really
weeks
from now. Yeah. Look for that. All right. This one's from Andrew Black. His top five movies he thought he'd hate. He has Broken Flowers, Dazed and Confused, The Thin Red Line, Nashville, and then 2001. Not a big fan of sci-fi, long and slow. I have ADD, not a good combo. The first time I saw it, I didn't like it. Now, it's my favorite movie ever made.
Quite a transformation.
Andrew Black, yeah.
All right, well, we got a ton of great lists here, but we're going to close out the segment with this one from Dan Garland in Long Beach, California. Great job, guys. I especially agree with The Matrix. You mentioned one of Keanu's previous seemingly similar movies, which was Johnny Mnemonic.
We couldn't think of it last
week. Not at the time. So I went to see this with a friend of mine thinking, just watch, this movie's going to bomb. In addition, the ads were vague enough that nobody knew what surprise was waiting for them. What a thrill ride it turned out to be. But the ultimate movie I thought I would hate was some chick flick a girlfriend at the time took me to see. The trailer was about two women driving from town to town robbing convenience stores. But Thelma and Louise turned out to be much more. When the opening shot faded in, revealing a lonely dirt road with the Hans Zimmer, Pete Haycock, deep soulful guitar backdrop, I somehow knew this film was going to be something special. That's a great example.
Yeah, it really
I mean,
is.
That's a great example for this right. top five, because I agree. I avoided seeing this movie for the longest time, thinking I'd have no interest in it. And I finally saw it and I really liked it.
In your top five chick flick movies,
chick
I think.
Chick flicks and also road movies.
That's right.
Okay.
All right. Well, if you've got feedback for us, send an email or a short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINNA. That's 206-203-2463. We'd love to hear from you.
When we come back, dry wit, dry martinis, and a dog named Asta. We kick off our screwball comedies marathon with The Thin Man, plus another round of Massacre Theater. Stay with us.
I live out yonder where the snakes and scorpions run. Got myself a little gold mine to bank on. But one day my heart sank when I saw
so he gets this piece of Pavarotti.
It was Paganini.
Whatever.
It was Paganini.
This is my story.
Then tell it right, cop.
Pavarotti is a tenor. Paganini was a composer. Okay. So he's got this music, and he's got it out in the water, and he's listening to it on his headsets, and he's just happy as a clam. And then all hell breaks loose. There's a whole slew of posts out of San Diego.
Including one way out at Pearl.
Including one way the hell out at Pearl. All of a sudden, they start hearing Pavarotti coming out their asses.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Hallgren. Time now for Massacre Theater. Last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from The Hunt for Red October with Courtney B. Vance as Jonesy and Larry Ferguson as Chief of Boat Watson, a tie-in with The Pirates of the Caribbean 2 and the long-lost top five nautical movies,
which you did not hear
last week.
Yeah.
Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Dan Heaton from St. Louis, Missouri. Congratulations, Dan. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Betty.
Yeah, Betty. Look, no, you don't rush it. I don't rush it. Okay? Now, we're going to play this nice and close, just like in the movies, okay?
And the sound of the music means it is time for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, tying in with our top five topic, as usual, top five mindbenders.
Yeah.
Conundrum movies, confusing movies, trippy movies. That's the topic. And we're going to say this. We usually don't actually just spell this out. It usually ends up coming out in responses to emails.
Right.
But this is a clear-cut case where the movie that we're using for Massacre Theater would have been in my top five.
Right.
Would it have been in yours?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, it would have been in our top five, but we actually held it off because we wanted to save it for Massacre Theater. So, right. Sam, you are going to start, so I'm going to give you the action.
All right.
And also one quick note.
Oh, yes.
There is, you know, if you have kids in the car,
Earmuffs.
That's right, earmuffs. There is some vulgar language in this. Only one. A little bit of it, but be aware. Here we go. And action.
How did you get me into this?
You offered to help me when you saw what this guy did to me.
How do I know he did that to you?
I came to you straight after he did it. I showed you what he'd done and asked for your help.
So I just take your word?
Yes.
Something feels wrong. I think someone's fucking with me, trying to get me to kill the wrong guy.
Did you?
What?
Kill him.
Of course not.
And scene.
Mind-bending rendition.
Yes, if you know what film Sam and I just
I
massacred.
I tried to throw everyone off the scent.
Yeah, it was nicely done. It was so poorly acted that there's no way anyone will get
it.
Wow. Send us an email by Monday, July 24th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Tuesday's show. We're about to jump in, Sam, to our next marathon.
Yes.
Screwball Comedies. Yeah. And as a nice segue, one bit of email feedback we didn't get to in the last segment is this one from Angela in Chicago, who wrote in and sent her list of top five movies she should have hated. Actually, top five marathon movies.
Film Spotting Marathon.
Have hated. So why don't you go ahead and read this here?
Yeah. Angela writes, I go into every marathon film thinking I'm going to hate it. These films have a lot to live up to. 5 minutes of boredom, and I'm fighting the urge to fast forward. The extra long dance scene in An American in Paris, I couldn't resist. It's like going to the dentist. You know you should, and it's worth it in the end, but you just don't want to do it. You would think that since the hate turns out to be unfounded, I would change my ways. Give up the notion that any movie from the 1930s is a bore. But my trepidation cannot be swayed. My movie watching time is just too precious. Even so, here are my top five marathon movies I should have hated. The Searchers, The Thin Man, Swing Time, Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and Alfred Hitchcock's Frenzy.
Frenzy.
Thanks for helping me push past my reluctance, Angela in Chicago.
I think that's our new tagline, actually, Film Spotting. Pushing you past your reluctance. I think that's a great
natural
great
abhorrence.
Quote. Yeah, but
black
she's
and
got
white films
in here where she, when she finds the time, she checks out about every other marathon, it sounds like. But when she gets into them here, she's found that some films that she thought she'd hate, she enjoyed. And one of them was The Thin Man, which is our first film here.
And it's important to note that in many cases, that's why we haven't seen a lot of these films.
That's a great point. That's
exactly
why.
You know,
exactly
we're pushing past our own.
We didn't think we would like Westerns. And as we said, when people write in and go, sorry, I didn't play along because I hate Westerns. Well, that's how we felt too. And then we watched them and discovered that there's some great stuff. And The Thin Man came out in 1934, directed by W.S. Van Dyke, the first of five Thin Man movies. It's based on the final novel by famed hard-boiled writer Dashiell Hammett. Nominated for four Academy Awards, Sam, Picture, director, actor, and adapted screenplay. And of course, it is a murder mystery, a detective story. Some people wonder why it would even be part of a screwball comedies marathon, right. But it's in the marathon for a reason. Namely, the mystery is secondary to the witty banter of William Powell and Myrna Loy as the fun-loving, hard-drinking married couple, Nick and Nora Charles. This was the second of 14 collaborations between Powell and Loy, and this was a popular choice, Sam, among our listeners in connection to a recent top five back on FilmSpotting, Cinecast number 86, top five drinking movies. But it would also have been a good candidate for our top five movies about marriage, number 28, our top five screen duo, show number 22,
Man
and frankly,
alive.
Frankly, I think a case can even be made that Nick Charles belongs on our top five badasses list from show number 34.
Good
so I want to know from you, how bad do you feel now about having not seen The Thin Man before compiling those lists?
Yeah, I would have altered every one of those lists, absolutely. That being said, and again, I know I'm treading on very shaky ground here, but the fact is, this movie was, I don't think you mentioned the fact, it was made on the cheap, really cheaply, shot in like 14 days or something like that, never expected to be a blockbuster at all, total B-lister, despite the stars Powell and Loy. To me, honestly, it feels like it. I loved Powell and Loy. Absolutely loved them. But for me, there really isn't much more to this film than them. Those scenes are absolutely electric. They have amazing chemistry, like the kind of chemistry you just don't see.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole problem of the film in terms of like, you know, Powell's reluctance to take the case and the missing thin man and I didn't care.
Yeah.
I was kind of bored by it, to be honest. And I kept waiting for more scenes where, you know, Powell was downing martinis and exchanging witticisms. But the fact is, I ended up thinking about it like this, you know, where we obviously showed some sort of natural reluctance to dive into, early cinema, you know, the golden age of cinema in some way. We, you know, that's one of the reasons we're doing this marathon. And I think a lot of people are, fairly, unfairly, probably unfairly. But this isn't the kind of film, this isn't going to be the first film I show people to change their minds, honestly. You know, compared to, you know, what I use as, you know, in my limited experience with films of this time period, I still go to His Girl Friday for a film that is just packed with wit,
mm-hmm.
And just incredible performances. Speaking of two stars that have chemistry, you know, Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell. And as far as the stars are concerned, these two are a match, but the story, I don't think holds up at all.
Well, no, I agree with you a little bit, to the extent that this sounds just like my complaints back when we did our musicals marathon,
sure.
And I complained about American in Paris having a lame storyline and Swing Time having a lame storyline, but just like Swing Time, and I found myself comparing this movie a lot to Swing Time as I watched
it. I did,
too. The Powell-Loy duo is very similar in their chemistry and their banter with each other.
Yeah.
As Astaire and Rogers. They have that same vibe, that same chemistry, though, with Astaire and Rogers. They do it dancing than with their mouths, you know, which is here we get it in talking. But there's that great chemistry between those characters. And I felt like I was, like I said, just watching Swing Time a lot. And just like with those movies, ultimately that's what carries the movie through. I agree with you that the story is flimsy. And when you get to the end and you've got this kind of, what do they call it, like a chamber play or a drawing room detective story, where you actually get all the suspects in
Agatha
one
Christie
room.
Agatha Christie all of a sudden,
Yeah, you get all the suspects in one room to have dinner, you know, and you find out who the bad guy is, you know. It's funny. It's comical. The mystery isn't all that compelling. And in fact, I have to say, the first 10 minutes of this movie bored me to tears.
Yeah.
I thought, if this is what this movie's going to be, because it's setting up the story.
Yeah.
We don't see Powell and Loy for the first 10 or 15 minutes of this film. We're getting all the backstory, and it's not interesting.
No.
The story of this scientist kind of disappearing and whatever, it's not that fascinating. And I thought, wow, we're in for a long haul. But you know what? The minute they go to that bar and we see William Powell telling the story about how you shake a martini, even that, though, didn't hook me. It was when the moment I knew I was in for the ride with this movie was when Myrna Loy shows up, when his wife shows up, and they sit down at a table, and she says, how many drinks have you had? And he says, this will make 6 martinis. And she says to the waiter, all right, will you bring me 5 more martinis, Leo? Line them up right here. That line, the way she delivers it, the fact that it's hilarious just in that she would even think to match him is the joke, obviously, but there's an interesting bit of equality there that sets up the whole movie. This idea that, right, you've had six drinks, well, I'm going to have six drinks. And the way that there's no sort of disparity between the man or the woman in this marriage, the way it functions is so fun to watch.
Yeah, there's so much affection.
That's when I was hooked.
And you just don't see that. I mean, I read one description of it. It's like they act like an illicit pair, you know, having an affair on the side as opposed to a married couple. And it's so exciting and endearing to see. And it's right. She's exactly his equal. And whether that's, you know, as it's written or more likely what Myrna Loy brings to the picture. And she's just totally magnetic. But you did mention musicals, and I certainly had the exact same thought. And to me, really, this film felt like a musical without the sublime pleasure of the singing and dancing. Okay. I felt like there's a couple great scenes, and they all contain really just the banter between Powell and Loy, the rest of the story. I mean, just even the characters, the secondary characters are no more than, you know, cardboard cutouts, mm-hmm. really. I mean, they don't strive for anything more than that, despite the, you know, Maureen O'Sullivan, I think, is really nice. I mean, she shows a little bit of dynamic to it, to her character. And Cesar Romero, I was actually looking as Chris Jorgensen. He has this really strange, like, heavy sort of presence that almost is out of step with the nature of the film. But all in all, I mean, yes, see it, but I have a feeling that there are going to be greater discoveries in this marathon.
No, I agree with you completely. I had the same thought. I know we're going to watch better films. Yeah. We're both going to have stronger reactions to other films in this marathon. But you know what? This is a case where it's a fascinating thing to go back and watch a movie from 1934, realize that this is the Depression. And here you've got up on screen rich people living sort of decadently, and yet you get the sense that, and I'm probably painting with a broad brush here, but you get the sense watching it that people really could go to these movies and just escape and get into it, just like they did with Swing Time, just like Mia Farrow does in The Purple Rose of Cairo, going to that theater despite her rough life. She can strive in some way, aspire to be like them and just escape into that world. And it's a curious thing, though, to be rich like that and yet come off in a way that people don't hate you. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think you would watch this if you were a person who was struggling during the Depression. You wouldn't go and watch. You'd envy them, but you wouldn't hate them. You'd find them just really interesting people, and you'd maybe want to be more like them.
Yeah, and the more decadence, the better. I think it is hard, and they absolutely pull that off, absolutely. And I don't think what I want is more reflection or a deeper, more psychologically true story. I mean, that's not my complaint about this film. It's just, it's mildly fun, but maybe not as fun as I thought it would be.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. I guess where I do differ, as I said just a little bit, is you mentioned that if you're going to tell someone, hey, you got to watch screwball comedies, you'd start with His Girl Friday, and maybe I would too. Yeah. I think it is a better film than The Thin Man, but I wouldn't hesitate at this point anyway to put The Thin Man up there pretty high on the list, because despite the flaws of the story, and like I said, the first 10, 15 minutes that just really doesn't work at all, that dialogue, it's a lot like watching a movie like Brick, too. You know, we talk about the dialogue, just the banter, the way they talk, the pace of it, and the timing, and the funny lines is so good, I think. And it brings you so much pleasure that I would recommend it to people. I would say The Thin Man is something you need to see. I mean, there are some lines in here, Sam. I read that one, but at one point Nick says, I'm a hero. I was shot twice in the Tribune. I read where you were shot five times in the tabloids. It's not true. He didn't come anywhere near my tabloids. I mean, those are good lines.
Yeah, they're nice. They're good lines. And I was thinking of it as like their version of special effects in some way.
Right.
It's just like, it's the perfect, like, it's what people go to the movies for, to hear language that no one else is using in their daily lives. And it's like, yes, absolutely, there are exchanges like that.
The cop says, you got a pistol permit? No. Ever heard of the Sullivan Act? Oh, that's all right, we're married. I mean, there's a little bit of raciness to this movie.
Sure.
I really did enjoy as well watching a married couple.
I loved it.
Not only be equal, but have that kind of affection for each other, that kind of love and that playfulness, being able to cut each other down, but know that underneath it, you know, that they obviously have a lot of joy. They get a lot of joy from each other. I thought it was great.
It's too bad he actually sends her to Grant's tomb for 15 minutes of the movie. She really should have been there.
Yeah, that's true. So anyway, I guess, you know, we both liked it. I liked it a little bit more than you did. We'll see what happens next week with the next film in our marathon, Sam, which is My Man Godfrey. Carol Lombard hires vagrant William Powell again.
William Powell. Can't wait.
In Gregory LaCava's My Man Godfrey, where he does play her butler, another movie featuring rich people. We'll see what happens.
Time for one more quick break. We'll count down our top five mindbenders when we come back. Stay with us.
Blood is flowing and mountains are blurring. There is something stirring way down inside. Barely know my home base home. See
Listening to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and we're in the home stretch here. Sam, we're going to get to our top five mindbenders, and we'll set that up here in a little bit. But before we get there, I did want to give a shout out, a thank you to all of the Film Spotting listeners who turned out last week during my trip to San Francisco for a little Film Spotting meetup. I've had the occasion now, Sam. You've met a few listeners here and there,
That's true.
I met with seven people out in New York City and had a great time, had a drink, talked, went and saw a movie. Same thing out in San Francisco. Eight listeners showed up. Actually, seven listeners. Beth brought a friend with her out to our little meetup afterwards. But we got together. I was out in San Francisco just for baseball. Every summer I go with some friends. We saw a couple baseball games. Saw Pearl Jam on Saturday night.
Saturday
and
night.
Sam, you're a music snob. So I just wanted to throw out there. I wanted to say, I hadn't really listened to a lot of Pearl Jam. I knew their stuff, but I hadn't listened to a lot
of it. I was obsessed with Pearl Jam,
though. Until I saw them live in concert. And now, Mr. Music Snob, I want to ask you, tell me one,
why are you putting me on this
tell me one band in America that rocks harder.
Harder than
that's
Pearl
tighter
Jam.
Right now, a better rock band than Pearl Jam.
Canada's The Constantines. See them in a small venue near nowhere near you.
What are you talking about?
I'm just being, fulfilling your desire for me to play the part of the movie snob.
Play the snob, the music snob. Yeah, you're the movie snob, too.
I'm telling you, I was thinking about Pearl Jam recently. I don't know why, but freshman year of college, it was a Monday night. You know how they release new CDs
on Tuesday?
Midnight, you know, October 1993, I was there waiting to buy my copy of Versus. So,
were you really? You were that big of a fan?
I was that big a fan.
I brought this whole music snob thing up only because I had such a good time at the concert. Their new album is fantastic. The live show was one of the best
I've
seen.
Suicide,
It's a good song. I recommend it. Anyway, so we saw that, saw some baseball, saw Pearl Jam.
Don't call me
some,
daughter.
They didn't play that at my show. I was disappointed. On Sunday, though, got together with Kathleen, Daniel, Jim M., Jim B., Nick, Mike, and Beth. We went and saw The Unholy Three, a Lon Chaney silent film. Had a lot of fun with that. Maybe I'll talk about it in the upcoming Dope Sheet. And we saw that movie at the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. And then we went out and had a drink, hung out for a couple hours, and just talked. And I really had a great time. I want to thank everybody who came out. And we had actually about 20 to 25 people who emailed at first expressing interest. And then only seven or eight showed up. And at first I was a little disappointed. And then I realized it was the perfect number.
You could actually hang out
and talk and have a good time. So, again, I want to thank all of you for coming out. I enjoyed meeting you. And now with that said, let's get, Sam, to our top five mindbenders. This is a case where we were actually planning a different top five for this week. We were going to do drug movies tying in with, would have been a perfect tie-in with A Scanner Darkly. But we have Miami Vice coming up. So we're going to save drug movies for that. We thought an even better tie-in.
The mountaintop of drug movies.
We thought an even better tie-in was top five mindbenders. So, Sam, what movies for you just missed the cut, and did you use any criteria?
I did use a criteria. I'm glad you asked. For me, it was where a film creates a world where the rules are not entirely clear to you as the viewer, or a world where you've been deliberately kept from knowing all you need to know to figure out the story in some way, and that at some point you decide to go on that journey with you. You submit to the world, because I think these kind of films can risk being pretentious or boring or both. And for me, I have to say, Scanner Darkly completely fits the criteria for a film like this. And for me, it ended up boring me. Maybe I'll revisit it and find
it's not
that
pretentious
it's redeemed.
Or boring.
I don't find it pretentious. I really don't.
But
I found it boring. But anyway, that's a criteria I used. And the films that just missed my cut, Darren Aronofsky's Pi, Tarkovsky's Solaris, Clean Shaven. I don't know if you've seen this
film,
the Lodge Kerrigan film about starring Peter Green about a schizophrenic, and it's really from a schizophrenic's point of view as he looks for his daughter. A really disturbing film. Eyes Wide Shut. A lot of people don't like this film.
I'm with you, though.
But I walked out of this movie completely and utterly paranoid, and I didn't know exactly why. And I think it's a really effective last film from Kubrick. And 2001, another Kubrick. 2001, Space Odyssey almost can't create a list, a mind-bending list, without mentioning it.
Yeah, talk about confusing and confounding. And actually, I called my list the 2001 yeah. Memorial list.
Well, I like the fact that he set out really to create a film to raise questions that he didn't have any intention of answering, which is, I think, really effective.
Okay, well, my 6 through 10, the movies for me that just missed my cut, and I realize it's so hard because you basically could have put any Godard film on here, any Fassbender film on here, or any of the Pasolini films that I've seen. They could all go on these Mindbenders list. And for me, I use the words confounding, trippy, confusing. The other kind of criteria I used, I guess, would be if forums actually exist where people are debating the meaning of the film, then it's a good candidate. Not all of them fall into that, but that makes a really good candidate. If whole websites are devoted to the meaning of a film, that's what we're talking about with a Mindbender. For me, Blow Up, Antonioni's film from 1966, any movie that has an extended sequence where people are pantomiming a tennis match with an audience watching them. I mean, you want to talk about surreal, Blow Up gives it to you. I also had Solaris on there. Yeah. We loved Tarkovsky's Solaris. I mean, it's a masterpiece, and yet, if you asked me to explain it to you, sorry.
Yeah, we did try our best. Don't go back and listen to it. But yeah, you're put in the position, really, of the main character who's traumatized and trying to figure out this world. Yeah.
True. I also put on another film we reviewed way back on maybe Cinecast number 10, I think, Primer. Primer, a very good choice. They're a good candidate. Another time travel movie that is really hard to follow. Waking Life and A Scanner Darkly. I put the Linklater duo, that pair on here. And I also have on here, I wonder if you thought about these films, Sam, or if you even put them in your top five, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and Being John Malkovich. I went with a little Kaufman pairing there because these are films that, again, it's not like when you're watching them, they're really that hard necessarily to follow, but sometimes things are just so bizarre, so surreal that you always feel like you're playing catch up and trying to figure out who you're supposed to be paying attention to and what they're doing.
And you do and have to sort of submit to the world, absolutely.
Yeah, they're out there. They're kind of trippy movies, and so they made my list. But now let's get into the top five.
Top five musical crimes perpetrated by Stevie Wonder in the 80s and 90s go. Sub-question, is it in fact unfair to criticize a formerly great artist for his latter-day sins? Is it better to burn out than to fade away?
You mentioned it, but my number five is Shane Carruth's Primer. It's a film that, I'm not smart enough actually to understand this film, but the fact is, once you decide that Carruth knows what's going on, and I do trust that he knows what's going on. In fact, he told us he knew what was going on, and we believe him. And that's enough for me. And really, you mentioned it. It really is time travel sci-fi done on the cheap for about, what, $7,000 or something? Ridiculous?
It was ridiculous, yeah.
And done really, really well. And, so for me, yeah, absolutely confounding, absolutely fills all that criteria. But just trying to follow it bends the mind, if you
even
will.
The opening scene is 10 minutes of these
jargon
software guys, these tech guys talking in their garage trying to invent something, and you have no idea
and
what
how
they're
effective
talking about.
That is, I mean, really, where you just have to pay attention, knowing you're not necessarily going to get any information you can hang on, but the way he draws you in that way.
I agree, it is a great choice. My number five definitely falls into that category of multiple websites existing that their only purpose is to try to explain this film, and that's Donnie Darko, Richard Kelly's film from 2001. This is a movie, again, time travel, loopholes. You have a demonic rabbit named Frank and a character named Frank, and I'm sure they're somehow linked, but I have no idea how. Numerous paradoxes in this film. You've got alternate universes, and it's funny because right after I saw it, literally right after I watched it on DVD, I got out the DVD commentary where Jake Gyllenhaal sounds a little bit like an idiot throughout the thing.
He does. And I totally lost respect. Yeah. That's where I lost respect for him.
Yeah,
was
maybe
listening
it was.
To the commentary. You're
he's
right.
He's kind of a
he tries to keep up with the director, and he's a jag-off.
But even Richard Kelly, he doesn't explain the movie on the commentary. Of course, any good director isn't going to explain the movie, but watching it, listening to it, you're like, I do trust him, just like you trust Carruth. Yeah. I really do trust that Kelly knows what he's doing, but maybe not to the same extent. I don't know if he can really explain down to the smallest detail exactly what the movie's about, but you know what? It doesn't matter. I love the humor. Yeah. I love the soundtrack, and I find all that sci-fi stuff fascinating. I love the film.
I don't know if we'll ever compile a list of top five films that were ruined by their director's commentary, but honestly, Donnie Darko, for me, is one that actually that qualifies, where I really liked the feeling of being confused by it. It absolutely would have qualified as on this list, a mind-bending film where I wasn't sure where I was and what had happened, and then I remember him giving me too much information.
He does give you more than you would expect.
And more than I needed, and it actually ruined the film for me.
Okay.
Anyway, my number four is a film you actually saw recently, which prompted me to see it recently, not something I'd seen before, THX 1138, George Lucas from 1970. this film was such a surprise for me. Just released on a sort of deluxe two-disc DVD, and it's absolutely fascinating and surprising. And the thing is, I honestly watched this film on the way here, on the train. Part of the reason it qualifies for my top five is that once I stopped watching it, everyone on the train looked like they'd had their brains sucked out of their heads. Uh-huh. Like, it really changed the way I was perceiving reality in that, I mean, it really is, I mean, I couldn't help but think of Tarkovsky, really. I mean, the way, really, the world that he creates, this bright, dark, black and white world, you know, in this film starring Robert Duvall and Donald Pleasance is fantastic. I don't know what he's doing in the movie, but he's fantastic. And
he's quoting Richard Nixon most of the time, actually.
Is he really?
Yeah.
I think the movie's really fascinating in terms of what it says about society. It's smart. It's interesting. The movie, about halfway through, I wasn't sure where Robert Duvall was running to or from, and
right.
I sort of lost interest, but it really deserves being looked at. I know it's probably overlooked by a lot of people because there just wasn't a chance to get a hold of it. Now there is.
And especially when we rip on Lucas so much for the Star Wars movies recently. But you know what? It's my number four as well, Sam, so that works out well. THX 1138, this is a film that listeners wrote in telling us we had to see because it wasn't on our dystopias list.
It wasn't on our sci-fi films list
because we hadn't seen it and we'd avoided it. Maybe a top five movie we should have hated. I expected to hate this movie.
Absolutely.
Because it's Lucas and whatever.
I imagine it to be pretentious or faux pretentious.
And yet, you know what? It's his first feature released in 71. I should have given it some credence because Walter Murch, who's a brilliant editor and sound designer, co-wrote the film with him. But you've got this movie, where this futuristic world where basically the government, you know, they give you drugs that remove all sexual desire completely and just turn you into consumers.
Yeah.
And this is something like with Philip K. Dick in A Scanner Darkly, where you feel like he's getting at something down the road, something futuristic, and yet there's something grounded in the reality of our time.
Yeah.
Absolutely, you can see those parallels. And the thing that I liked the most, I mean, let's face it, not a lot of dialogue here. And when they are talking, you don't know what the hell they're saying. Because like Primer, they're talking about numbers and jargon that you don't get in this world. But that's good in a George Lucas film.
Yeah, it really is.
And especially here where you get the visuals, where I loved all the similarities to Star Wars here. There's a car chase scene here that literally sounds and looks just like the scenes of Darth Vader in a TIE fighter going after Mark Hamill. I mean, you know, going after Luke Skywalker.
And when the robotic police force is using their wands, it is the sound of the lightsaber.
Yeah, it is. It's very similar. And so just from a visual standpoint, compare it to Star Wars, the first one, with some of the shots here. It's really great. And I also love, too, another connection kind of with Primer, is the way he does just throw you into that world.
Yeah.
He never tries to explain, this is how we got here,
this
is what's going on. You're a character, you're Robert Duvall, you're a mindless drone that has to go to work every day and do what you're told.
Yeah.
And I love that about it. I really did like it too.
Yeah, I did too. And I mean, honestly, you didn't have to sit through this film last year, but I realized how much Michael Bay and the writers of the Island stole from it.
I thought about that watching it. Yeah.
Really good film. All right, well, my number three is really thanks to Film Spotting listeners. Particularly, I want to thank Nick Palmer, who recommended it, I think, after mentioning 12 Monkeys on a couple of lists. I think it was my number one.
Nick Palmer, who I got to hang out with
in San Francisco. That's right. Said, you got to stop talking about 12 Monkeys until you've at least seen Chris Marker's La Jetée, a 28-minute film, really, that is a montage of a still photography that's narrated. And it really does tell the story of this post-apocalyptic story where the scientists of the future are trying to create time travel in order to avert the crisis that's occurred. I watched this film at night and had absolutely the most terrifying apocalyptic dreams I've ever had all night that night. And I think you can't say anything more about a film in terms of qualifying as a mind bender for it to have that kind of effect. And really, it's not like there are scenes or shots and shots of post-apocalyptic world.
Not really, no.
But it's the way it's able to convey that reality is really unbelievable. And just the effectiveness of the very simple nature of just the narration and the photography, absolutely chilling, and really just how effective that ending is. I mean, I have the kind of, and it's a gift sometimes, the kind of bad memory in that I couldn't remember what happened at the end of 12 Monkeys. And so really, the end totally took me by surprise as well.
Well, yes, thanks to Nick Palmer, I was able to watch this movie as well, though I just have to admit, it's not on my list because I didn't get to finish it. I know it's only 28 minutes long, but with all this traveling I've been doing lately, I just could not fit the whole film in. But watching the 14 minutes I've seen,
it's amazing.
I'm not surprised it's on your list at all. It is brilliant. My number three is a movie. Well, it's the movie from this year we love the most so far, Brick.
I almost
this noir set in a modern-day high school. Really, maybe some people think, does this really qualify like a film like a THX? But really, if you're talking about movies that confound you, that have you at some point asking, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
Which is another piece
should
of criteria
I
used.
Yes,
yeah.
I should.
This is another one. And it's really, again, about the dialogue. This is a case where the dialogue goes so fast that you just cannot keep up with it. And it's only on the second and third viewing that now I listen to certain scenes from it and I know exactly what they're saying.
Yeah.
At the time, they could have been speaking German.
Right, right.
That's what it sounded like. But now you actually understand it. You know where they're going with it. And it's not only, it's the speed of it, it's the slang, and it's kind of that 30s detective slang that they're using. And of course, you've got a case where characters are always double-crossing each other.
Right.
Who's good, who's bad, who's really on the level and who isn't. And you're trying to follow all that and put it together, along with being confused by the dialogue. It confounds you, and yet it's great fun.
Yeah. No, it's a great. I almost put it on there, and I was just thinking a lot of these films that are in my top five and even in my top 10 actually had a sort of visceral impact, at least on how I was perceiving the world after I watched them. The second one is kind of a stranger. You mentioned Charlie Kaufman, Spike Jonze. You mentioned Eternal Sunshine and Being John Malkovich. My number two is Adaptation, actually, only because not so much that the film is mind-bending in terms of visuals or the world it creates, but I really, and I think I've talked about this before, I wasn't sure I understood the choice that Charlie Kaufman, the character Charlie Kaufman, the screenwriter, makes about halfway through the film, where it becomes a kind of different kind of film,
mm-hmm.
in some sense, thematically in some way, in terms of how the characters behave. And I honestly was up for two nights after seeing this. Like I was trying to figure it out, puzzling over it. And it's funny, I came across A.O. Scott's review in the New York Times at the time, and he mentions the same thing. It's one of those rare cases where you read a review and it's like he had the exact same experience mm-hmm. I did, where you trust the filmmakers enough to know that they made a decision intentionally and they fulfilled their intention, and I didn't get it and I wanted to, and then I did get it, and it has that kind of satisfaction. I know you don't necessarily like
it. I don't like it as much as you do, but
I think it really works, and in that respect it qualifies.
Okay, I agree it does. My number two is one I'm not sure that it's really come up that often on the show, and that's kind of crazy because it deserves to, and it's Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation. Mm. And again, I don't know if people remember this film from 1974 and think of it as that confusing, but I've seen it a couple times, and I'm always confused by it because you've got, it's a nice tie-in actually with A Scanner Darkly about paranoia and being, surveilled. You've got Gene Hackman playing a character who that's what his job is an audio surveillance person, and he's got this one phrase that he recorded during a job that he becomes obsessed with, constantly trying to deconstruct it, the meaning of it. And every time he gets new pieces of information, it changes the way, the meaning of that one phrase. And you're along with him, along for the ride, trying to figure out what the hell does that phrase mean?
Huh.
What is going to happen? Is someone going to get killed? If so, do they deserve to die? Who's going to kill them? Whatever. You really just don't know, but you always know that something bad is going to happen, and you're like him. You're trying to prevent it. And so it is a movie that does confuse me, but that I really like a lot.
That's a great pick. All right. Our number one, I imagine, is going to be shared. So we say it simultaneously. Mole, Holland
Drive.
David Lynch. For me, again, this is the number one film because honestly, and not unlike when I watched THX 1138, when I walked out of the theater, I wasn't sure I understood at all what was going on. I'm not even sure I cared, but all of a sudden, all the way home, walked out of the Landmark Theater at Diversity and Clark, all the way home, walking home, on the train, everyone that I looked at looked like a complete freak that had just walked out of a David Lynch film. And it's like, if somebody can really change the way you see the world as effectively as he does. And again, there were times during Mulholland Drive, I remember it, and I haven't revisited it. At the same time, I did go to one of those sites to try to explain it to me.
Yeah.
I haven't revisited it, and there were times when I just didn't care. I had given up on it. There were times where I was completely enraptured by it. But the fact that I walk, I'll never forget it, being on the train and really feeling like people's faces were melting off their skulls. I mean that is a certain talent that David Lynch has that very few others do.
Yeah, no, it is my number one. And we should give some credit to Jamie Norris, who wrote in the day I was about to email you, Sam, and suggest that we should change our top five to trippy movies, to mindbenders.
Right.
We get an email from Jamie saying, here's a possible top five conundrum movies. Something interesting and complicated and puzzling and just beyond the grasp of my small brain. The first one that comes to mind is Mulholland Drive. I've seen this three times. Prior to my last viewing, I read, no, studied, memorized the 10 helpful hints for watching the movie, and I still don't get it. I don't even know if there's something to get. Help me, please. I don't know that we can really help you.
No.
And it's true. I mean, David Lynch has given, on the UK version of this, the Australian version, 10 things to watch for that will help you understand
really?
It. And yet, people are deconstructing those 10 things, and no one one can decide whether or not he's on the level.
The list itself
or
is mind-bending.
Yeah, exactly. Right. He's just playing another joke on you. It's just another layer of the film. But you know what? You could pick a lot of David Lynch movies, but compared to, you know, Blue Velvet is out there, but
pretty
compared to Mulholland Drive, it's pretty darn
just
straightforward.
A murder mystery,
But you know what? I love this film, and I have to say that watching it a second time, just like with Brick, just like with a lot of these movies, things do really start to make sense. And even if they don't make sense on a cause and effect kind of classic Hollywood plot, you know, way of watching a movie, it works on an emotional level. Yeah. It works on the visceral level. You understand the emotions that the characters have, the situations they're in, and the ante of this psychological becomes its own reward beyond where the plot is going. And it really does, in the end, become kind of this interesting satire of Hollywood about the decadence of Hollywood and the effect it has on these characters. So even if you don't understand at every little moment what's going on, it is interesting to watch it a second or third time and start to see little, you know, you're not going to understand what exactly the box is and, you know, what every little detail means. I don't think you'll ever get it, but in the end, does it add up to something? It does for me.
Now I'm concerned about watching it. And I watch Mulholland Drive, and all of a sudden my fiance Carrie turns into a complete monster of Lynchian proportions.
It could happen.
I don't know if that's really worth
Maybe you
worth
shouldn't
doing.
Do it.
Literally, I walked off the train after watching THX. I want to say this. I saw this guy wearing a shirt that said, "I'm a cool daddy-o." And I was like, what planet am I on? I didn't know where I was coming from. It was crazy. All right. Well, that is our top five. Please send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message.
Opening in wide release this weekend, Ivan Reitman's My Super Ex-Girlfriend with Uma Thurman and Luke Wilson, Monster House from producers Steven Spielberg and Robert Zemeckis, Kevin Smith's Clerks 2, and M. Night Shyamalan's The Lady in the Water. We'll review Clerks 2 and The Lady in the Water on next week's show. And actually, we'll have two shows next week. We'll have first our Chicago Public Radio edition of the show on Tuesday or Wednesday. It will include an interview with filmmaker Ed Burns. We'll also count down our top five male bonding movies. And then on Friday's show, we'll share some thoughts on Down in the Valley with Ed Norton and Evan Rachel Wood. Can't wait
for that
discussion.
That's going to be a showdown, baby.
And we'll also discuss the second film in our Screwball Comedies Marathon, My Man Godfrey.
Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. Also on the blog, sign up for The Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast.
Thanks to Calexico and Touch and Go Records for today's music. Please check them out on the web at tgrec.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Holgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting and by GoDaddy.com. Register your domain name with GoDaddy and get free hosting with a website builder, a free blog, complete email, and much more. As a Film Spotting listener, enter code FILM3, that's FILM3, and get your .com domain name for just $6.95 a year. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
Linklater uses the interpolative... Here we go. Interpolative. Interpolative.
Why do you use words you can't say?
Because I am a pseudo-intellectual.